I'm Gabrielle Jackson, and this is The Full Story, Newsroom Edition, where Guardian Australia's editors discuss the news of the week.
Good afternoon, everyone. I'm here to release the Royal Commission.
This week, the Royal Commission into Aged Care was released.
I've spent the last few days poring over this. It's personal.
It's 8 volumes long and contains 148 recommendations. It's the 20th inquiry in 20 years, and they all point to the need for a radical overhaul of the system. But will the Morrison government make the drastic changes needed to improve the lives of older Australians? Today, I'm talking to Editor-in-Chief Lenore Taylor and Head of News Mike Tisher about the Aged Care Royal Commission. The Aged Care Royal Commission report came out this week, and it's something that so many of us can relate to because so many of us have had experiences of relatives or friends in aged care. Lenore, have you had any experiences with the aged care system personally?
Yeah, I have. And I think a piece that Amanda Mead wrote for Guardian Australia this week about the care or lack of care that her late mother received in a nursing home really kind of resonated with me. It was very similar to the experience that my uncle had in a Queensland aged care facility, in that individual carers were kind and compassionate and did their best, but there wasn't enough of them, and this whole system was so under-resourced that the care overall was totally deficient. And I remember my aunt feeling quite conflicted about complaining because she didn't want to reflect on the staff who were doing the very best they could. But, you know, if she wasn't there all day, every day, my uncle, who had advanced dementia, wouldn't have eaten anything at all and really wouldn't have got much care at all. And I think a lot of people find themselves in that situation and struggle with a system which, you know, reports over the years and now again an 8-volume report show is just completely broken.
Mike, what about you?
I don't have direct experience of the aged care system in Australia. I do in another country, but very many of us are going to have to deal with the aged care system in some form or another, either for ourselves or for our relatives. But it's one of those things that we probably prefer not to think about until it happens, like superannuation. Everyone wants to pretend that it's never going to happen to them, but in very many cases it is, as the population ages particularly. But by the time it is upon us, obviously it's too late to change the system that we have to deal with. So it's better to think about it now when we have a huge report to digest.
Yeah, speaking of that quite lengthy report, I don't know how many people have been through the 8 volumes yet, but can we say anything about what the main findings of this report were?
I think that, you know, if you boil it all down, the report found that the care we're giving our elderly isn't good enough. 1 in 3 of them get substandard care. 13 to 18% suffer physical or sexual assault. The system's bust. We're not spending enough, not nearly enough. Obviously, regulation and oversight is completely lacking, and we need to completely overhaul things. And I think maybe the most important thing that the report found was that we have to start from a completely different place. So the old Aged Care Act started from thinking, how can we cut costs and how can we ration services? And what the report is saying is the new act needs to start from thinking, what rights should elderly people have? What kind of care and support are they entitled to? And in practical effect, that means that the whole system isn't capped anymore and it isn't divided into different bits. It's a system where if you're old and you need support, you get assessed and then you get what you need. That's the theory, but obviously that's a massive change that costs a massive amount. It's a huge overhaul. But I actually think that fundamental point of starting from a whole different starting point is really important and absolutely right.
And there has been some criticism to the initial response, hasn't there, from experts? We all of a sudden found ourselves in a situation where we were kind of arguing about how much more money is needed and where it's going to come from. And a few people, I think there was this great quote from Joseph Ibrahim from Monash University who said, "We're arguing about whether we're going to pay with cash or credit card or Apple Pay when we don't know what we're actually paying for yet." Mike, have you heard criticisms along that line?
Yeah, so at one point, it's an obvious point that the report makes that the system needs more money into it. And there are divided opinions on how best that can be done, either through the tax system, either by or by people who can afford to pay through their super or through other means-tested, you know, ways of accessing their money, the assets that they have, if they can afford to help to contribute towards their care. I think all of those are reasonable suggestions. You could argue over which one's better than the other, and no doubt people will. But the problem is that even if extra money is found through one of those systems, who is it going to, and what is the guarantee that it's going to be spent for the benefit of the people in residential or home care rather than for the benefit of the people who own privatised residential care homes?
Yeah, and Lenore, you just said regulation and transparency of what is needed. There is a lack of that at the moment, isn't there?
Yeah, there absolutely is. And the commissioners who wrote the report were a bit divided about how to best govern the sector and how best it should be overseen. But they both say there needs to be a new independent watchdog and new standards because the ones that are there now just aren't good enough. And I think any sort of perusal of the report makes that very, very obvious. And they sort of, in some cases, they suggest very specific new standards, which are really important, like a minimum amount of staff time per resident in a nursing home. They say it's got to be at least 200 minutes per resident per day, which sounds bureaucratic, but that means staff have time to listen to what residents are saying and to observe what's happening. So, you know, if you go back to Amanda Mead's point that I referenced earlier, she told the story of staff in the nursing home not noticing that her mother had dentures on the bottom, and so they had never cleaned them, and her whole jaw had become infected and skin had grown over the dentures, and they had to be surgically removed because she had dementia. Nobody had had time to really talk to her or listen to her. So those kinds of technical, they sound bureaucratic, recommendations actually are the things that will force nursing homes and to spend the money that is required to provide the care that people need. I mean, they also are saying now that they're going to phase in the requirement that nursing homes have a registered nurse and that the staff have to be better trained and better paid. I mean, these are like the fundamental things that if those recommendations are implemented, then we might actually get somewhere with this report when so many reports before haven't actually managed to change the system.
As in so many other industries that involve caring for people, whether that be old people or very young people, such as childcare, the bulk of the workforce, by far the largest part of the workforce in aged care, is unskilled, poorly paid and undervalued. And it really does require us to change the way we think about the value of those occupations if we're going to make a serious change in the quality of care that people receive. I mean, it seems like an obvious point. But untrained, unskilled, poorly paid, poorly motivated, you know, staff who are run off their feet in many cases because there aren't enough staff are not going to provide the kind of care that we would hope for us.
And you can add to that often casualised.
Yeah, exactly.
And I guess we found out during the pandemic that some of those occupations that we pay less well and, you know, haven't paid much attention to are actually occupations that we need the most.
And they're mostly women.
That was the other point I was going to make about the pandemic.
Yeah, staffing seems to be one of the major issues. And I remember in John Howard's reforms that they actually removed the requirement to have a registered nurse on site 24 hours a day. And there's been a lot of criticism about those reforms, that act, in this and many other of the reports. Can you break down what the major criticisms have been?
So the Howard era Aged Care Act was really based around how to cut costs and how to ration services. And I think the report found that there had been decades of efficiency dividends that had cut something like $9.8 billion from the annual aged care budget. And it turns out that wasn't very efficient from the point of view of the human beings who were supposed to be being helped.
Well, people said at the time that it would lead to exactly the problems that it has led to.
And every report ever since has said what's happening. Like, people did notice.
Yeah, so my mum actually worked in aged care for more than 30 years and she managed a bunch of nursing homes in Sydney. And I remember her writing a submission to the Senate inquiry about this and saying, like, if it happened, staffing would be cut, patient care would really suffer. And pretty much everything that she wrote in that submission has come true. And it's actually the reason that she got out of aged care, because it was so demoralising to see that deterioration. And actually, it happened pretty fast. They cut staff pretty quickly. And as this report has said, staffing is the major issue, but staffing costs a lot of money, especially if you're going to pay staff fairly. Mike, will the government act this time?
Well, I mean, I'd just like to go back to what Scott Morrison said when he was launching the report on Monday, which was that we need a generational paradigm shift, which is what the report itself strongly suggested as well, as Lenore just explained. But I'm not convinced by any means that his government is in a good position to produce the generational paradigm shift that is actually required to transform this sector, because it fits into the way we run a lot of sectors that are, you could loosely group under sort of human-centred sectors like childcare, like education, like TAFE, like parts of the health service, where we've relied on the private sector. We've outsourced as much as possible to cut costs, privatised. There are for-profit operators involved. That has not worked well in any of these sectors. And I don't think the Morrison government is the one that is likely to transform that in any realistic way that will really transform the paradigm, to put it in his words.
What do you think, Lenore? Are they likely to roll back privatisation of aged care services?
No, I don't think that is likely. And I'm not sure the extent to which the government will act on these recommendations. They sort of promised an initial injection of $450 million or something, which is chicken feed compared with what's needed. That's just sort of the starting point. They've said that there'll be more to come in the May budget. Scott Morrison didn't sound wildly enthusiastic about a levy in the first response. He said that needed to be thought through. And, you know, that's reasonable. It does need to be thought through, because what the commissioners are suggesting is quite a fundamental change of phasing out the system now where families have to find huge deposits to get a loved one into a facility, you know, sort of refundable deposits. And usually that means they sell the family home, and then in favour of a levy that would guarantee a certain standard of care as a right for most people. As Mike said, that's kind of philosophically not really super in line with where the Liberal Party is usually coming from, and it's a really, really big shift. On the other hand, this is an issue that affects so many families. So I couldn't predict exactly how the government will respond, but I think that if a major party had a good go at a policy to implement some of these recommendations and make proper change in this area, I reckon it would be, you know, a pretty powerful policy to take to the next election.
I think there's a big question here about how people who have to deal with the system on a personal level exert political influence to reform it, to help change it. There was a lot of comment after the report was released on how the representatives of the industry, people who own the industry, own the nursing homes, have the ear of the government, but the people who live in them and work in them very much do not. And there's a new grouping of peak bodies which is trying to exert that pressure by targeting particular seats, some coalition, some Labour, some independent. Whether that is the right way to mobilise the people who, because there are people, as it all says, there are people across all social classes and all parts of the country who have to deal with the system. It's not confined to any particular group, but the people who are confronted by the aged care system. So it feels like there should be scope for some political force to be put behind changes. We saw at the last election how retirees got extremely animated about franking credits. And so it sort of feels like there's a constituency to be won out there, but how to mobilise it, that's a different question. Also, the polls show that people are prepared to pay more taxes to fund aged care or levies or whatever if they were persuaded that it actually would improve the system.
Yeah, the persuasion is key, isn't it? Because Ian Yates from the Council on the Aging actually said he thought about a third of the companies currently operating in the sector shouldn't be there. They're just not good enough. And being convinced that you're getting a good service means getting rid of those poor providers. Is that where we need to start? Is that what we, you know, really the first steps of regulation and transparency are?
But transparency is only part of the problem, isn't it? You can allow people to see how well a nursing home is doing on a range of indicators, but if there is only one in their area that they can easily access, or there are several that all perform poorly, or the ones that perform well are too expensive for them, then that doesn't help much. You need to have the choice of good facilities as well as just being able to see which ones are better than others.
This is an enormous problem, which is, as Mike said, going to require a paradigm shift from the government, and we're maybe in an election year. Can they get away with delaying action till after an election?
I don't think that that is feasible. I think that both major parties will have to respond in detail in a thought-through way to this report. I think voters will hold them accountable for that. I think this is a big enough issue in many voters' lives that, no, I don't believe they can get away with just doing nothing until after the next election. This is sort of about who we are as a society.
Next, a shining light and a dancing fish. It's time for our regular segment on what news stories we couldn't get out of our head this week. What was it for you, Lenore?
Two words, Grace Tame. Oh. The political debate around sexual assault and sexual harassment and the treatment of women is so dismal, dark, so dark at the moment. And she was just a bright light. She was straight talking and honest and hopeful and powerful.
Share your truth. It is your power. One voice, your voice, and our collective voices can make a difference. We are on the precipice of a revolution whose call to action needs to be heard loud and clear. That's right, you got it. Let's keep making noise, Australia.
So that's what I can't get out of my head, Grace Tame.
Me too. She was a ray of sunshine when we really needed one, wasn't she? She's so inspiring. Mike.
So I obviously completely endorse what Lenore said about that speech. It was amazing. But and at the risk of seeming like the trivial person in this conversation.
You never seem like the trivial person, Mike.
My story is completely different. I can't get it out of my head for a quite different reason. And it involves some disparate parts, so just bear with me. So Rebecca Paulson is a DJ who was quite famous back in the day. And when I say back in the day, I mean about 10 years after I stopped paying attention to music. So
the 90s?
No personal experience of her, but she was famous. She is a DJ. She's also studying neuroscience at the University of Queensland. And she has been playing the MC Hammer 1990 track, You Can't Touch This, to Baby Zebrafish through speakers that are no bigger than 1 centimetre wide. The purpose of this is, the research is to develop something that might be of benefit to people with autism. So it's very serious research. It's not frivolous in any way. But I must admit, obviously, it will be wonderful if it does produce a benefit to people with autism. But even if it doesn't, I'm very happy to live in a world where researchers at one of Australia's top universities are playing MC Hammer to Baby Zebrafish through speakers 1 centimetre wide.
And there was that great video of the little baby zebrafish brains lighting up with lights as they listened. It was so great. Have a time.
Can I just get a bit of a dance from everyone in their computers, please?
Absolutely not.
Well, thank you, Mike and Lenore, so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks, Gabs.
That's it for today. If you liked this episode, don't forget to hit subscribe right now, wherever you're listening to this podcast. Today's episode was produced by Miles Martignoni, Ellen Leibeater, Laura Murphy-Oates, Raf Katuma, and Ryan Pemberton. The executive producers are Miles Martignoni and me, Gabrielle Jackson. Thanks so much for listening. Laura Murphy-Oates will be back with you on Monday.